Dzień dobry. Słuchacie Państwo podcastu Polityki Insight, platformy wiedzy dla liderów polityki i biznesu. Co tydzień nasi eksperci omawiają najważniejsze wydarzenia polityczne i gospodarcze, analizują krajowe, europejskie i globalne trendy. Ja nazywam się Marek Świerczyński i w Polityce Insight prowadzę dział bezpieczeństwa i spraw międzynarodowych. Zapraszam na kolejny odcinek naszego podcastu. Jest wtorek, 24 stycznia. W specjalnym obronnym wydaniu podcastu Polityki Insight wita Marek Świerczyński. Dziś oderwiemy się trochę, choć jak się zaraz okaże nie całkiem, od polskich zbrojeń i wojny w Ukrainie. I spojrzymy na świat z perspektywy antypodów. W związku z Międzynarodową Konferencją Wsparcia Zbrojnego dla Ukrainy w Europie i w Polsce gościła w ubiegłym tygodniu delegacja z Australii. W Warszawie był zastępca szefa sztabu obronnego, wiceadmirał David Johnston, który spotkał się m.in. z zastępcą szefa sztabu generalnego Wojska Polskiego, generałem broni Piotrem Błazeuszem. Admirała udało mi się namówić na rozmowę, w której omawiamy bardzo ambitne zbrojenia Australii, wnioski, jakie wyciąga ona z wojny w Ukrainie oraz sytuację geopolityczną na Pacyfiku, gdzie głównym zagrożeniem jest rosnąca potęga Chin. Tematy to pozornie odległe od polskich realiów, ale sam rozmówca już nie. Admirał Johnston był dowódcą dwóch fregat typu Adelaida, które miały być pozyskane dla polskiej marynarki wojennej, ale ostatecznie trafiły do Chile. Mimo tego niepowodzenia obronne relacje Polski i Australii nabierają dynamiki. W styczniu rezydujący w Berlinie attaché wojskowy Australii został akredytowany w Warszawie, a wizyta admirała Johnstona koncentrowała się wokół wsparcia, jakie jego kraj, co ciekawe drogą powietrzną, dostarcza przez Polskę Ukrainie.
For me it's a opportunity to come and both thank Polish counterparts and the Polish government for the support that is being provided to enable the assistance that Australia is able to offer to Ukraine, and we are very grateful for the assistance in that provision. But also, you are very close to what is happening in a very important part of the world for us, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, the consequences of that. By being here, I get a more direct understanding of a view from a country that understands this part of the world very well and helps inform the judgments that we will make, the advice that we provide to our government based on the knowledge that I can get from being here. So it's a great pleasure.
And of course, we will focus on the Australian point of view on your Pacific theater and things going on there. But let me continue for a second on this, you know, European topic. Australia is a member of this, you know, multinational coalition supporting Ukraine in different dimensions, militarily primarily. You were one of the first nations, I believe, to donate armored vehicles to Ukraine. And you said that in a way you rely on the assessments of countries located closer to the theater, closer to Ukraine, like Poland. And of course, you know, everybody is looking at the United States perhaps for leadership in those efforts. But what is the Australian assessment of the current stage? We were hearing so many news about the upcoming offensive of the Ukrainians, or maybe the upcoming offensive of the Russians. We're hearing, you know, leaders from the Western democratic world speaking about the crucial moment again that we're in, you know, at the beginning of 2023.
I think our assessment is very consistent with the judgments that you are making here. And as you said, we are enormously informed by those insights. 2023 looks to be a very important year. We've observed through the last year the extraordinary resilience of the Ukrainian people, their capability to regain territory in a very difficult fight and amongst many, many casualties that have been experienced both within the community and those fighting. So this year does look to be substantive. It will, in many respects, give all of us an indication of how much territory Ukraine is able to recover, the elements of resistance, and we are all watching the Russian mobilization and how that may be applied within the theater. Coming out of the winter here and seeing the ongoing fighting that occurs and the trends that emerge in the months that are ahead will give us all a much clearer indication of the type of developments that will occur through 2023 and the type of support that Ukraine might need.
What conclusions are you taking as a professional military officer and more broadly as a deputy chief of defense for Australia? Is there anything in this war that made you, you know, think twice about Australian requirements or Australian visions of defense or about the nature of modern warfare?
Australia, like all nations, are viewing the conflict as occurring and recognizing each of our circumstances are different. This is a land campaign that is being fought from countries who know each other very well and have long histories between each other. But there are some clear trends that are either being reinforced or emerging as issues that we all need to understand. Many of those are outside of the world of defense departments. Impact when nations come together, the utility of sanctions, how do you change the calculus for national leaders or those who are supporting them for the types of activities that Russia has embarked in. But in a military sense, the power of leadership and what happens when you can unite both a defense force and your community in the way Ukraine has, and President Zelensky has been remarkable in what he has achieved and what his people has achieved. So leadership clearly very much matters. The resilience of your communities and their willingness to defend their country and hold to what they believe in and be prepared to risk their lives to do so has an enormous impact on the types of military actions and the way that military forces can be employed. We are reminded and of a trend that has proven over the centuries but gets forgotten more often than it should, the power of logistics, the ability to resupply and make sure forces have what they needed. In our own region, distances and the difficulty of transportation complicate logistics enormously, but the conflict here has shown that logistics are the key enabler that provide you the ability to press advantage when you need it or to hold and defend when you might wish to do so. The use of weapons or the consumption rate of weapons, whether that is precision guided missiles, artillery rounds, what we have all observed is an extraordinary rate by which munitions are used in a conflict, even one that has a geographic boundary that shrinks and expands at time. But we've learnt the importance of national stockpiles, your ability to regenerate military capability, particularly munitions, to those consumables that determine the ability for you to continue to apply force when you need it, are heavily limited by the munitions capability that are available to us all. And I think industrial capacity has become clearer for us, and not just the industrial capacity of Russia directly or of Ukraine, but the ability of those nations making a contribution and understanding how quickly our own industrial systems can regenerate and replenish our stocks has been tested. I think for all of us, we've learned and made more complicated by coming out of a COVID world where supply chains have struggled. The ability to move goods over borders has been more difficult, but we again, logistics support, industrial capacity, the ability to arrange forces when you would need it has been powerfully demonstrated. Information and intelligence and surveillance. Guided munitions are good, but when you know where you need to use them and the innovation that we have observed and use of a variety of civil systems and military systems in order to fuse information and be able to rapidly apply it with effect in a battle space has been quite remarkable. So that's perhaps just a taster of many observations that have mattered to us all.
We could spend, you know, a few hours discussing all these issues. To us here, you know, bordering the theater of war, one of the greatest worries is the use of air attack weapon system, be it precision guided missiles, you know, all the calibers and all the Iskanders that the Russians can use, but also those systems which, you know, have demonstrated already their capabilities in some other wars, like in Nagorno-Karabakh or in the attack on Saudi installations, or, you know, on a daily basis in Israel. That is the low, slow-flying attack systems, basically. I wonder, Australia seems as though it is so distant that it is quite immune from that kind of aerial threats. On the other hand, it is so difficult to defend Australia from both ballistic and earth-breathing threats.
Long-range weaponry is one of the most substantive developments of the last two decades, and Australia is looking at our own capabilities to project force through long-range weaponry, and that requires, I occasionally remind people, because there can be a fascination about the weapon, but of course to effectively employ long-range weaponry, the further it can go, the more complex your targeting requirements are to ensure that you are able to use weapons well. So you are right that short-range systems and some of, whether it's the application of drones or other capabilities, are less significant. We're fortunate to be an island continent that has a very large moat around it, which changes the types of military capabilities that are effective either for defence or in the way that we might use our military capabilities. But it, as your question was implying, that if that means that the types of weapons that might be used offensively against Australia are long-range systems.
Sort of more serious systems, including hypersonics,
land attack cruise missiles, ballistic missile threats. There is no one defensive system that is capable of operating against all of those threats, which means being in a defensive environment, you need to layer your defensive capabilities, but it's an expensive proposition. It has high risks at its efficacy, which is why you can't rely on defense alone. You have to have other means available to you to either impact the weapon system before launch, or using means like cyber and other capabilities to be able to impact the calculus and effectiveness of any potential adversary for the way they use long-range weapons.
And of course, Australia is one of those countries, one of those nations who have made one of the boldest, one of the most radical defense procurement decisions in the span of last few years. Here in Europe, also because of one of the parties involved, we've been watching with great interest the change of decision about the submarines, obviously. It is a statement of strategic importance, switching from the sort of classic propulsion to nuclear propulsion. Tell me, why was that decision made? What does Australia aim to do with that capability?
You are absolutely right. For a country that does not have a nuclear power industry, nor have we employed any systems that have a nuclear propulsion capability, the decision around the procurement of a nuclear submarine is a very significant national decision to make. But the rationale behind it is one of the key characteristics of Australia is the long distances for either a nation to be able to approach Australia or for the effects that Australia might wish to apply within our region. If you are a conventional submarine, you have an exposure rate because you need to come up and recharge your batteries. You have long distances to be able to patrol. So there is an impact on the lethality of the platform, the speed, the endurance, but most importantly, its survivability. Snorting, when a submarine has to come to the surface to be able to recharge its batteries in today's environment, and this is where it is very different from an assessment a decade or more ago, but the advances that have been achieved in space-based surveillance systems, whether they be electro-optical, radar-based, infrared-based, means that platforms who emit or have a signature to them are significantly more vulnerable than they were a decade ago. We were building a conventional submarine that we would have in service for over the next 30 years. And the conclusion we formed was the technology that was needed to make that platform relevant required a propulsion system other than nuclear. And that coincided with our ability to access technology which had not previously been made available to Australia, and which led to the judgment of we had to go a different path, and we're very fortunate to have the United States and United Kingdom supporting us in that endeavour.
In other words, it required strategic decisions on more than one part, yes, more than Australia, yes, also yes. The United States
and the United Kingdom. It was not a gift within our national ability to do without assistance.
But there is more to it in terms of development of new technology with the United States along with the United Kingdom, and not only in terms of submarines. Australia has been, again, you know, in terms of the boldness of your programs, Australia will be the first country to employ something called a loyal wingman, a robotic aircraft accompanying a future fleet of F-35s.
I think there are two parts to your question that I will answer. And one is the other part of the AUKUS arrangement, which is about advanced capabilities. And loyal wingman, or ghost bat as the platform is now called, is not a part of the AUKUS program. But we do recognise the pace of change of technology and military capabilities in the Indo-Pacific region, and I accept it's not limited to that, but it is quite acute in the Indo-Pacific region, means that we needed to do more to advance capabilities in the service at a quicker rate than we had previously been able to. Slow delivery rates mean that the risk of technology obsolescence is a real one. And the other part of the AUKUS partnership, and it is a capability partnership, if I could take the opportunity just to reinforce, it's not an alliance, it's not a diplomatic relationship, it is a capability enabling relationship. This was all about harnessing the ability where three nations' interests coincide with each other on capabilities that we would progress together. The Loyal Wingman or Ghost Bat program, which is an Australian program, is very much about establishing an air-based uncrewed vehicle whose objective is to work with crewed systems, fighter aircraft and others, to be able to address one of the key issues that we have in our defence force, and that is the ability to generate mass. We're a relatively small defence force that has very good in niche areas, but we are not a large defence force. That means generating mass is a challenge for us, and uncrewed systems in the air domain, surface or subsea, are one of those technology areas we believe are really important. So the Ghost Bat program is just that. It looks at how do you use an uncrewed aerial vehicle, but most importantly, how do you team it with other platforms in a way that can involve human interaction or has a degree of autonomy on it? In military terms, we'd say exercises a mission command, and you use a platform to be able to supplement capabilities in a mission without necessarily having to direct every movement of its task, like if you were hand controlling a UAS system.
I believe you are exercising these ideas, yes? You're making your war games with the assumption that you have this capability. What does it bring to the theater?
It brings the ability to employ, as I said, mass into an area. UAS systems generally, and particularly with the Ghost Bat program, of course, mean you can put platforms into a higher risk environment than you may wish to put a human crewed platform. So it gives you other ways of prosecuting military objectives while reducing the risk to life. It enables us to harness technology that can be being developed for undersea autonomous systems and take them into other domains. So it has a great latitude to move technology between platforms. You can produce relatively small numbers of them and then either decide to substantially change your approach. So it's a wonderful platform to innovate with, change sensor packs, change the way you might consider its fueling or endurance capabilities and trade-off. I think there is a lot you can do because of the size and the innovation that is coming out of mining sectors, a whole series of other industrial applications that we're all trying to blend into UAS systems that we're employing in the air through the subsurface application.
And as you've mentioned, you also will be employing these underwater systems like that.
We have a number that we are experimenting with, and I appreciate we're not unique as a military force in doing that, but each of our circumstances are slightly different. The size of the Australian coastline and the extent of our continental shelf and exclusive economic zone means that uncrewed systems have enormous utility. We're looking at them for surveillance purposes, for on water and below water surveillance with systems that are remote powered by solar and wind, can stay at sea for very long periods of time. We have a contract with a company called Andrel Australia, where we're developing three large submersible vessels for which we're experimenting on their application for sensor payload delivery. So it's a very exciting time to see what it's capable for, but our geographic circumstance and our strategic circumstance are a very neat combination that suggests these are really important capabilities for us to invest in.
But of course, despite the importance of submerged and uncrewed capability, I mean, for you personally, it must be the surface combatant capability which is most important as for a Navy officer. And also in this respect, Australia's plans are pretty ambitious.
We have a very substantial investment program for the future, and that's being currently reviewed. I think the pace of technological change and the developments that we've seen in a geopolitical sense in the last 2 years means that countries need to keep coming back and revalidating their plans, testing them through war games, drawing judgments from that. Australia has an independent review underway at the moment that will be presented to our government by the end of March of this year. And its purpose is to do exactly that, to understand what are the capabilities that are relevant to our future, how have they changed from the plans that we have in place, provide those recommendations to government. We have a very ambitious modernisation program. We've moved from a view of three domains with a heavy focus now that adds space and cyber to it. So our ambition is significant, but the need to identify what's important and then focus our efforts on that is significant too.
And I believe one of the decisions pending on the review that you've mentioned is how the mechanized infantry will look like. Yeah? The Redback program, or the, how is it called, Land 400 program in Australian terminology. So there are some armed forces who are struggling with how to answer the question, what about the army in the Pacific theater? And of course, I'm talking about the US approaches, yes, how to deal with the threat in the Pacific. What role should be for the army, except for the Navy and the Air Force, for obvious reasons? What is Australia's vision?
Our view is all five domains. So the maritime, land, air, and as I mentioned, space and cyber, all of them are highly relevant. I'm reminded by my army colleagues very correctly that humans live on the land, and it is the land terrain where outcomes are generally decided for those conflicts that exist. So in our region, as in all others, and all domains are important, but the land domain is not diminished in its requirement that is critical to the defence of our country. It's important for our territorial integrity. It's important from the way we would conduct missions from disaster relief through to potential combat operations within the region. So the questions about an armour is particularly where it's most prevalent, and people are looking at the conflict in Ukraine and forming some judgments about the utility there. All of us are trying to transpose those to our own circumstances. But there's no question in our mind that the land domain and land-based capabilities remain important. They affect the spectrum of operations. And the areas that we think there will be an emergence of new focus is particularly land-based fires. So the ability to use access to land to impact maritime and air operations, to hold territory that you wish to force project from, all of that requires robust, capable land forces. We're confident that that will be an important part of the work we will do.
But as you said, Australia is not a large country. Of course, it's a huge country by territory, but in terms of population, it's not as strong. And the requirements of your theater that you're exposed to is just so huge that you cannot do it alone, and you're doing it with partnerships and alliances. And of course, your prime ally, just like in case of Poland, is the United States. And again, there's going to be some important changes in the US posture in the Pacific coming. One of those will be the semi-permanent, or will it be permanent, rotation of the US Bomber Task Force in Australia?
No, it won't be permanent, but you are very right that Australia is a very large continent with a relatively small number of people on it, and partnerships matter to us enormously. There's not a conflict we've been involved in that we have been fighting by ourselves. Our history is when the Australian military is engaged, then we are operating with partners. And like Poland, the United States is the foundational partner for us. And we're fortunate to work with many regional countries. We've worked with NATO significantly in the past, but the US is very much at the core of the security relationships that we have. The arrangements, some of which are long-standing, rotational presence by US forces in Australia, have been underway for a number of years. From 2011, the Marines arrived, or the agreement was made for them to arrive in Darwin on a rotational presence. We've had a long-standing US Navy agreement. We occasionally remind the US 7th Fleet that they were born in Brisbane during the Second World War as their genesis. The US naval presence in Australia is very long-standing. At our recent defence engagement between the Australian Defence Minister and SecDef Austin, which occurred in December of last year, they've reinforced those elements that are important about what US force posture in Australia might be. There will be, and we have had for many years, air detachments, B-52s present in Australia over the last 12 months, B-1s and B-2s have come and exercised and worked with our own forces there, and we would expect that to continue. The Marines will continue. The US Navy rotational presence through exercises has been an important part and will grow in the future. And I think we'll see an expanded activities with the US Army in Australia. So it's important that this course lifts capability up for partner forces. I think it's a very important element of a deterrence message by having these occasional presence of US forces in Australia. And in those circumstances where a response might be required from military units, whether that is disaster relief or combat, having the presence of those forces is important, valuable.
In terms of bombers, we can bet quite safely that one day we will see a US Air Force B-21 Raider landing on Australia. And maybe we will see also an Australian Air Force B-21.
There might be many or some in our system and others who are speculating on that. Of course, the US has said that they're not at a stage where they're offering B-21s to any other partner. But from what I understand, it is a very capable platform. And yes, it may have a presence with the US forces in Australia in the future.
All of this is, of course, for the purpose of defense. And while here in Warsaw, we're looking to the east, we're looking to Russia as the main threat, you're looking to China as a problem, maybe not yet as a threat, or perhaps it is described as a threat in the Australian strategic documents. I don't know. Please tell me. But do you see any similarities between Russia's and Chinese behavior? Do you see any threat in them becoming closer partners in security and defense? And finally, since there is this US link to both Western Pacifics and European security via the United States, what could be the combination of the defense cooperation between NATO, US, Australia, Europe, Pacific, Atlantic, Pacific, etc.?
So we do see similarities in the principles that have been violated here in Europe to the principles that are important in the Indo-Pacific. Larger nations should not be able to make a decision to invade smaller nations. The rules-based international order is important to be observed no matter what size a country is or its interest that may apply. So the principles that we believe have been violated here through Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine are important all around the world. And that's our view, is that those principles should be upheld within this region and they should be upheld within the region that we are. We have seen that President Xi has publicly made comments about the relationship between China and Russia. So there is clearly a relationship there, and that is of interest to many nations within the Indo-Pacific region who understand what those implications of that partnership might be.
Vice Admiral David Johnston, Deputy Chief of Australia's Defence Staff, thank you very much for this conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Na dziś to wszystko. Na kolejny odcinek podcastu Polityki Insight zapraszam w przyszłym tygodniu. Posłuchajcie również naszych innych audycji, które znajdziecie w większości aplikacji podcastowych. W pole wyszukiwania wpiszcie po prostu Polityka Insight. Słuchajcie, obserwujcie i komentujcie. Do usłyszenia.